The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. If you've been with us for any amount of time, you know that I cover cults. I'm fascinated with cults, like many of you are, because I truly don't understand how people can become convinced of things I find to be ridiculous. I grew up in a high-demand religion, Mormonism. I have since left, so I'm sure that also plays into my fascination with cults. When I talk about cults and their leaders especially, I often have a hard time controlling my laughter, and I often get what I call the church giggles, laughing at inappropriate times. That's just something I've always done, and it gets me into a lot of trouble. But I don't think I'm going to have that problem today. This isn't one of those cult stories that we're going to be really laughing at much. It's not that all cult stories aren't disturbing. They are. But most of them are not as dark as the story we're going to be talking about today. In fact, I've held off on talking about this story for a while because the things that happen are so upsetting that I have to be in the right frame of mind to want to dive in. But dive in I did. This story is unique to me because I have never come across a story where people are willingly letting these kinds of things be done to them. The things I'm going to tell you about in today's story are things that normally only happen to victims who don't survive. But the people in today's story are willingly allowing these things to happen. Well, the word willingly might become relative, as you will see, because when you're in a cult, do you really do anything willingly? That's a question you'll have to answer for yourselves. It's a question I struggle with all the time. But this is a horrific story. It is the story of Roche Theralt and the cult called the Ant Hill Kids. I'm your host, Stacey Lee. Let's get into it. May 16th, 1947. Roche Theralt was born in Quebec, Canada. His father was involved in a religious sect known as the White Berets there in Canada. This is a small group in the Roman Catholic religion that promotes their own brand of socioeconomic religion, and they do a lot of proselytizing. Part of what they do is much like what Mormon missionaries do. They spend a lot of time going door to door, handing out literature. And as a child, Roche was made to assist his father in this effort. So while other kids were out playing on a Saturday, Roche was walking around the neighborhood handing out pamphlets, and the other kids would tease him and even throw rocks at him when he was doing this. Now, Roche was a very intelligent child. He got high marks in school, and some of his teachers considered him gifted. But because of this teasing that he endured because of his father's religious beliefs, Roche began to grow a hatred for organized religion. He also later made claims that his father was abusive to him. His father always denied those claims, so that's something we will probably never really know, as his father is long dead. As Roche matured, his hatred for all things religion grew, and Roche began to develop his own theories about God and the natural world. By the time Roche was a teenager, he had read the Bible multiple times, and he decided he was going to drop out of school to study the Old Testament full time. I think he was 13, maybe 14, when he decided this. Roche believed himself to be more intelligent, more tuned in, and superior to most people, and he was frustrated that others didn't always see him that way. Roche Thorault was a pensive, troubled man. Intelligent people often are. He thought a lot, and he worried a lot, and by the time he was in his late teens, he had developed stomach ulcers. He had surgery for those ulcers, and the surgery did not go well. Doctors cut away a large portion of Roche's stomach, and he did not heal well. He ended up with something called dumping syndrome. I mean, could we have maybe come up with a better name there for that? People with this condition do not properly digest food. The food doesn't stay in their stomach long enough. It passes through their stomach and into their intestines too quickly, and it's very painful. So Roche was now living in pain, and he was furious with the medical community. His beliefs then began to include thoughts that the government and the medical world were in cahoots to hurt people and give them medicines that they claimed would help them, but would really make them sick. Oof, this sounds a little too familiar lately, right? Roche lived in constant pain, and I can tell you, I'm sure some of you already know this. Being in constant pain makes you mean. It makes you short-tempered at times, and it changes your personality. Roche started drinking heavily, and then he started doing drugs. I'm sure the pain had a lot to do with that, but so did the era. It was the late 1960s, and drugs and alcohol abuse were very prevalent. But after a time of being intoxicated almost constantly, Roche realized that wasn't working for him. Despite his hatred for organized religion, he decided to attend services one day at a Seventh-day Adventist church, and that day changed his life. Roche claims that God spoke to him on that day and told him the apocalypse was coming, and he was needed to fight in the battle that was to come because he is so very special. These guys are always very special. They're very, very special. Roche quit drinking, and he quit drugs, cold turkey, on that day, and became totally devoted to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In that church, he quickly became a superstar. He knew the Bible backwards and forwards, and he was considered more knowledgeable than most. On November 11th, 1967, Roche married a local woman named Francine Grenier, and together they had two sons, Roche Jr. and Francois. Roche made his living as a wood carver. He made little sculptures and trinkets, and as you can imagine, that did not bring in much income. Now, I also have to bring this part up. You'll have to help me out with this one because I'm confused. The ladies loved Roche. I am missing the boat on that one, but apparently he had like these ice blue piercing eyes that we don't really see in the photos of him. So I get that. But anyway, the women of the church adored Roche, and he adored the attention. During this time, Roche gained a new interest in sex and human sexuality, and this did not go over well with his wife or with her family. Roche was studying human anatomy almost constantly because of his health problems, and then he also started studying the sex organs and reproductive systems, and he became somewhat obsessed, as we will very unfortunately see later on in the story. Roche's stock in the Seventh-day Adventist Church continued to rise, and members thought of him really as a scholar and a leader. He would tell his wife that he had to go out of town to sell his woodworking pieces, but he was really leaving town to have sex with other women. One of those women was named Giselle. Roche's wife found out about Giselle. About the same time, the bank repossessed their house. So Francine was done with Roche, and she left him and took their two sons with her. Roche then began to really delve into a hardcore lifestyle of holistic nutrition and extremist beliefs. Now, we've seen this before with the Lafferty brothers and also with the Children of Thunder. There are others. But when a man becomes a rock star inside a church, everybody loves him, he either tends to go one of two ways. He stays on the straight and narrow, whatever that means for that particular church, and he climbs the ranks and becomes a leader. Or he decides that he wants to be the supreme leader. And of course, that doesn't go over well with the actual leader, and he gets excommunicated. Well, that's exactly what happened to Roche. He gets kicked out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church for proclaiming that he is Moses. He claims he is Moses and he starts calling himself Moise, which I guess in French is Moses. He says he gets visions from God, all the normal things these guys always say, from Joseph Smith to David Koresh to Erva LeBaron to Jim Jones. They're all cut from exactly the same cloth. It doesn't mean they don't know the Bible or aren't charismatic leaders. But yeah, they all have some very similar traits and experience similar things inside their own churches before starting their own. So now we've got a man who has had, we'll say, an unhappy childhood. He has medical problems that leave him with a lot of pain. He's got some real psychological issues and a lot of internal rage. And then he finds this community who loves him and admires him. And for the first time in his life, he's got this sexual awakening and desire to be around a lot of females. And now he's been thrown out of that place, that first community where he ever felt like the superstar he believes himself to be. And as we see over and over again, when men with giant egos and narcissistic tendencies get those egos bruised, disaster often follows. 1977. Roche being thrown out of the church angers some of his most devoted fans in that church. So Roche gathers them together and convinces them to sell their possessions, leave the church, and come with him. These were kids, basically. I think the oldest was 21. They were Solange Bollard, 21, Chantal Labrie, 19, Francine Laflamme, 18, Nicole Rule, 20, Maurice, no last name there, 18. Now, later on, some others joined the group. We'll have Jacques Fizet, Claude Alouette, Jacques Giger, and his wife Maurice, along with their six-month-old baby. I know I'm probably butchering these French-Canadian names. I'm so sorry. All of these people began hanging out at Giselle's apartment. Giselle is Roche's new girlfriend, the one that his wife left him over. By this time, Roche has decided that the end of the world is right around the corner. They were living in the last days, and Christ was ready to come back to Earth. So he told his followers, there's no need to go to college or to have a job. The world is ending soon. Wouldn't that be a relief in some ways? I'm kidding. Am I? Now, Giselle often got angry about the attention Roche received from the other girls in the group, but because she believed he was a godly man and because he had gotten sober, she accepted it. So Roche takes his group to a retreat on Lake Rousseau, and they spend some time there in the woods. There they meet Gabrielle Lavallee and Yolande Guinbert. Those two women join the cult. One day at this retreat by the lake, Roche goes off hiking by himself. He's out in the woods alone, and I bet you guys will never, ever guess what happens next. God appears to Roche in the wilderness. God is really big on the wilderness. He loves appearing in the wilderness. Roche said the sky lit up with a white radiance, and God appeared and told Roche he was a holy man in a holy place, and he had a plan for him. Roche returned to his little group with the news, and they couldn't have been happier. The group leaves the mountains and moves to St. Marie, south of Quebec City. Roche and the little group open a healthy living clinic that sold holistic foods and medicines that claimed to heal every ailment known to man. The cult members all wore a uniform, kind of like a nun's dress, down to the ankles, very plain. The women wore green and the men wore beige. And then, of course, Roche had his own special fancy little dress to distinguish him as the leader. This clinic brought in money and it brought in more followers. New followers began selling their possessions to help support Roche and his clinic. And people were just kind of fascinated with this intelligent man who knew the scripture so well, with the piercing blue eyes. And finally, Giselle ends up proposing to Roche, and they were married on January 8, 1978. At this time, Roche was doing some very dangerous things, like treating people with leukemia with grape juice and organic food, and those people were dying. They'd leave their cancer treatments and start guzzling grape juice, and soon they were dead. Roche would explain these deaths by telling people God spoke to him and told him it was their time. The treatments work, mind you, but if God wants you, he wants you, and that's that. All the grape juice in the world is not going to save you. I cannot. The other thing Roche did at this point before things really start to get crazy, and you guys brace yourselves for what's coming, is marry the followers off to each other. He coupled them into man and wife couples and married them, even though he had no authority or license to be performing marriages. Some of the followers' families attended these weddings and would sit and cry as Roche talked about the subservient role of women, how they should be slaves to their husbands and cater to their every need. Hey, Roche, cater this. That summer, Giselle, Roche's wife now, who was pregnant at the time, was feeling very ignored and worried he was having sex with the other women. So she gave Roche an ultimatum and told him, break up the commune and tell the followers to each get their own homes, or she was going to leave him and move in with her father. Roche's response was to punch Giselle in the face and lock her in her room for 2 days. And this is where the real violence begins. Then the store began to falter. It had been successful at times, but Roche refused to work. And so he went through money quickly. He closed the store and took the group from town to town. In July, they ended up in the wilderness of the Gaspé Peninsula. There, Roche had another vision. He informs his group that God has spoken to him again and told him, the world was coming to an end on February 17, 1979. He said there would be a storm of boulder-sized hail, lightning, earthquakes, and the earth would crack and open up, but they, the righteous, would be saved. They would live in the Appalachian foothills, and God would guide them after the apocalypse. The group hikes for 2 days, and on July 9, 1978, they reached a small lake at the foot of a little hill that Roche named Eternal Mountain. Roche declared, this is the place, and the group set about building tent homes. Once they had a camp set up, Roche told them it was time to build a large communal cabin. He would sit in his big chair and watch his followers scurry all over the site, working as fast and as hard as they could to please him. And one day, Roche told them, you look like little ants on an ant hill. And that is where the name, the Ant Hill Kids, came from Roche's laziness and his followers' fear and his refusal to do anything as the rest of them scurried around at his beck and call. This is the point in time where things become crazy isn't the word. Dark is not the word. Unbelievable is more accurate, but it's all true. Roche put the cult members in new uniforms, dark blue wrap shifts, and he began severely rationing their food. If anyone said they were hungry, they got nothing. The hunger got so bad that some left. Yolanda, for example, left, and so did the little family of three. They were the smart ones. There's kids at this point in time, little kids that are going hungry and being treated this way. The cabin was finished in September. It was made of moss-covered logs, and the group would meet there for religious services, and they'd also play music and put on little skits. Soon, Roche declared to the group that he had been keeping something from all of them. All of this time, he was never Roche. He has always been who he said he was back in his Seventh-day Adventist church days. He was Moses. He told the group he was their pappy, and he wanted them to call Giselle, his wife, Mammy. The cult members were collecting welfare checks, and each of the group members was giving Roche their check. They were living on about $1,400 a month. So, you know, that's like $5,000 or $6,000 now. You know, for like 14, 15 people, that's not a lot of money. But they did have some money coming in. Then Giselle found out that Roche had been having sex with Nicole Ruel, and Giselle ran from the cabin, hurt and angry. Roche chased her down and strangled her until her face turned blue. The next day, he announced that all of the marriages he had previously assigned and performed were null and void. And you are never, ever, ever going to believe what happened next. We've never seen this before. This is life-shattering, earth-changing, one in a million things. Roche needs to have sex with all the women. I know you never would have guessed that in a million years, right? All the women were going to have sex with Roche. It's cult 101, and he takes them all on as his wives. So he marries all of the women, Gabrielle, Solange, Nicole, all of them. Now, even though the cult was living in the woods, Roche had a radio and he kept a close eye on the news. And at this exact time, the Jonestown situation was occurring. Roche was obsessed with Jonestown. He listened to the news every day to hear some updates. And whenever someone went to town for supplies, he'd have newspapers brought back to him. People in the area were concerned that Roche's group was going to become another Jonestown, and the police were sent to talk with the cult members, and along with them, a social worker. I kind of want to cover her story from a different angle. Her name was Paula Jackson, and she gets really involved in this. Her story is kind of its own thing. But anyways, the police and the social workers get involved. Roche even agreed to go with the police for a psychological evaluation. Now, of course, he didn't tell them he was rationing food and beating the women. The police psychologist diagnosed him just as a religious nut and let him go. He was very, very manipulative and good at making people think he was harmless, like a good little psychopath. After this, things get so bad, the word bad doesn't even cut it. Roche completely abandons his holistic diet. He starts eating junk food and lots of cheeses and meats, and he starts drinking again. He even forces the young women, his wives, to have sex with the local grocer to pay for his food. Now, the members are not allowed to eat meat or cheese, and they definitely aren't allowed to drink, but Roche is, because he's special, of course. He started giving these long, like hours and days long, rambling, drunk speeches. And if anyone fell asleep, he'd hit them in the head with a wooden club. One of the pregnant women once ate extra pancakes from her rations, and Roche punched her in the belly and broke two of her ribs. Things just get so much worse from here. So if this is already too much for you, you will not want to hear the rest of this story because it's nothing compared to what comes next. I mean, it's not nothing, but you know what I mean. The doomsday date of February 17th, when the world was supposed to end, came and went, as they always do, and the world did not, in fact, end. Roche told them God had changed his mind, or maybe that God's time is different than man's time, and Roche misunderstood. But some of the followers start to get serious doubts at this point. The press started writing stories about the commune, and Roche was even arrested at one point and ordered to undergo another psych evaluation. Roche was so manipulative that he had the doctors believing that he was saving these kids from drug use and life on the street. Once again, they returned him to the cult. One of Roche's wives, Gabrielle, had health problems. They don't really know what it was entirely, but she fell into a coma, and after that, she died. There's a lot of discussion as to whether Roche did something to her or whether she just died, but Roche let authorities take her body for autopsy, and they found no signs of foul play. But this event scared Roche, and he vowed that all of the other deaths at the commune would be kept private. Now, you have to understand something. All of the women are either pregnant, have a baby, or have a toddler, like all the time. Roche ends up having 22 kids with these 8 women over the course of the cult's existence. One of those little toddlers' name was Samuel, and he was crying. One of the male cult members, a man named Guy Veer, grabbed the child by the throat and punched him in the face repeatedly. Roche hears about this the next day. He takes the child to his wife, who also acts as the nurse for the group, his original wife. The baby's head was kind of like bobbing around and he couldn't hold it up, and his penis was very swollen. Roche takes a pair of scissors and lances the baby's penis to allow the flow of urine, which had been blocked. When the group woke up the next morning, Samuel was dead. That's the official version of the story accepted by the courts. What I believe happened is worse, and it comes from a story from one of the wives. Roche decides that this baby is going to be circumcised. So he feeds the baby a bunch of alcohol, forcing the alcohol into the baby. And I'm going to stop there because it's just too much for me. Then Roche starts holding these trials for any type of infraction. If people commit any type of a violation, some of them they don't even know are violations until they commit them. They're made to do things like stand naked in the snow for hours at a time. He would hang them by their wrists for an entire day and overnight. Just really torturous and terrible things. One night, Roche became angry at Guy Veer, that same man that hurt the baby, and he decides that Guy is insane. Guy Veer has always suffered from really bad headaches, and so Roche decides that if he castrates Guy, his headaches will be cured. What does this head have to do with the math is not mathing, but the cult is definitely culting. Roche also tells Guy that this will relieve him of his excessive masturbation problem, and he has Guy sign a contract to be castrated. Roche then lays Guy Veer on the table in the middle of the commune, pulls out an elastic band and a razor, along with a pair of pliers and a magnifying glass, and castrates this man. When he's finished, he takes Guy's testicles, wraps them up in a Kleenex, and throws them in the garbage. Guy claimed it was not painful, but he bled for days afterwards and had to walk around with a compress. We're just getting started. Guy Veer then kind of becomes Roche's plaything. Roche would allow the other cult members to stab Guy in the chest and would sometimes tell them to kill him, but then he would call them off at the last moment, saying it was like Abraham in the Bible. Roche tormented this man, and some of the others were worried that at some point Guy was going to bleed to death. Finally, I guess castration wasn't enough, but the stabbing was. Guy fled the commune and went to the police. So the authorities raided the compound, found the dead baby who had been buried, and then took all seven children to foster homes. And there's this whole story about how at first, Roche kind of convinced the investigators that everything was fine. And because of this one social worker, she pushed the judge to look at the case. And then the judge was really upset with the social workers who didn't want to do anything. But I kind of want to cover that story in a different episode. But the kids were taken away from the cult, and Roche just, he's enraged by this. This finally did it. Roche, Jacques, and others, including Guy, were found criminally responsible for the death of the baby, Samuel, which they had tried to burn, but parts remained. And Roche was sent to prison for 2 years. I mean, Canada, come on, guys. 2 years for this? So the group goes and gets apartments near the prison to be close to Roche, and authorities were assuming this would be the end of it. Sadly, it was all far from over. February 1984. Roche is released from prison. He regathers his group and they set up a second commune in Somersville Township in Victoria County, Ontario. Roche claimed he had quit drinking and he said there wouldn't be any more violence. They built a new cabin and even created a little water mill. Roche no longer wanted to be called Moise, which is French for Moses, but he didn't want to be called Roche either. Now he was calling himself Rock. Rock is the English pronunciation for Roche, which is spelled R-O-C-H. So now he's Rock. These guys love to change their names. They love to change their names. They get bored really fast because they're psychopaths and they change things up a lot. The cult builds an A-frame cabin where they construct a kitchen and a bakery with a smokehouse and a root cellar. There was also this altar to commune with God. At this time, Rock had 2 male followers and 9 female followers, 4 of whom were pregnant. The state had told them any new children born into the cult would immediately be taken. But there were 10 children born during Rock's time in prison, and for some reason, not all of those kids got taken until later. Now, you know, of course, the violence did not stop. Rock claimed that one of the women in the cult had a birthmark that looked like 666, so she was made to live apart from the group. How he didn't know she had this birthmark before, I do not understand, because these people were naked 24/7. The thing is, because the group had moved from Quebec to Ontario, the people in Ontario didn't know of their violent history and just saw them as some hardworking religious kooks. Rock then had the women make special garments with large interior pockets for what else? Shoplifting. They'd steal vegetables and supplies. And one time when they were caught, they had almost $500 worth of goods on them. They didn't get arrested, but they were banned from the town stores. Finally, Rock decided that he'd try working What a concept to make money. And the group began selling fruit that they grew and pastries that they made in their bakery. And people really liked them. They brought in money. So it works for a few months, but then Rock gets bored with the whole thing and starts to drink again. There are stories of kicking contests to entertain him. He'd make the women wrestle each other in the nude. He made up a game with sticks and bats that he liked to play, but if you ever scored a point against him, he'd take your food away for 2 days. Of course, the violence escalated. Rock would actually use a whip, like an actual whip, on his followers. He'd hit them in the head with the side of an axe, sometimes with a hammer, and they were never allowed to get medical attention. This poor guy, Jacques, who had been with them from the start, Rock slashes his jugular with a wine glass one night, and he almost dies. And then he decides he's going to circumcise Jacques. He's very into men's sex organs. He's very into circumcision and everything that has to do with that kind of stuff. Jacques allows to be circumcised, which is just wild. One of the women had a baby in August of 1984, but the baby was born with a birthmark. Again, Rock said it was the mark of the beast, and he hated this child, his own child, and he often abused the baby. The child's mother was named Gabrielle, another Gabrielle, and she and Rock agreed to get rid of the child because Rock hated it so much. This woman takes her 5-month-old baby into the January snow and puts it outside in a wheelbarrow and just leaves it there. And the baby was dead by morning. Look, I get that these people are broken and I get that they're brainwashed. I don't really care. I don't have to like what they do. So then one of the families that's joined wants to leave the compound, and Rock says he'll let them leave if they'll leave their 12-year-old daughter behind for him to marry, which they do. Again, I don't really care what their issues are. Some things are inexcusable. Rock then starts other cruel activities. He takes two women's babies at times, both his babies, mind you, and he'll hold them over the fire and make the women beg to have her baby, the one saved. He never ends up doing it, but it's this sick game that he plays, and he takes great pleasure in watching the women beg. He really, really enjoyed that because he's a little teeny tiny thing of a man. If the children would act up, he would nail them to a tree by their clothing and have the other children throw rocks at them. He claimed the kids were being educated in a school, but the girls that were teaching at the school did not have much education themselves. The kids' teeth were rotting out of their heads. They were given very gross and unsanitary chores to do. I'm not going to go into it, but it was really bad for the kids. Okay, so this is where I'm going to tell you, I am not going to go into the sex stuff. It's too gross and weird for me. I don't want to talk about it. It's just bizarre. So if you want to look it up, you can look it up online. But everybody is involved in the sexual activity. Everybody. And Rock really wants everybody to be obsessed with, you know, his little Rock, because that's the most important thing in the world. Like, nobody's ever seen a penis before. I mean, give me a break. Every kind of abuse you can imagine goes on for years. And then the local authorities kind of catch up with them, kind of get wind that they're in a different part of the country. Now, at some point in this period of time, Rock discovers the Mormon fundamentalists. These are, in my area, the polygamists. They're the FLDS, the people who dress like it's the 1800s. You've seen them on TV. If you remember back in my episode about the Lafferty brothers, there is a point in that story where the Lafferty brothers go north and meet with a commune that is really into this idea that men should masturbate each other. And there's always been this rumor that while the Laffertys were with this group, they engaged in homosexual activity. Now, I could be totally off on this. I am not an expert on the timelines of how these cults match up, but I think there's a really good chance it was Rock's group. The Lafferty brothers went north and met up with Joseph, who was a polygamous leader in Salt Lake, and he was hooked up with Rock's group. I think this might all be connected. I'm going to look into it further. I kind of ran out of time and I had to film, but I want to know more about this. So Rock becomes good friends with a polygamous leader, Alex Joseph, who has his family in Big Water, Utah. And then Rock starts to take on some of the Mormon fundamentalist beliefs. And he also makes some trips to Utah during 1986. This is right around the time of the Lafferty brothers, the whole thing with the baby and the wife. And if you haven't seen that episode, this is the thumbnail. You can go and watch it. It's an interesting story, but a very sad story. One night, Rock goes into a drunken rage against Claude, who had been with him since the beginning. He orders Claude to wrap an elastic band around his scrotum. Of course, after a day of this, Claude is experiencing terrible pain and swelling. So what does Rock do? Takes out a razor blade, slices out one of Claude's testicles, and then cauterizes the wound with a hot piece of iron. Just, you know, as you do on a Tuesday. Rock then starts to think Claude might need to be stoned to death. The other group members step in and say no, they don't want Claude to get stoned to death. So Rock gets a torch, like one of those torches that you turn on, and he says he's going to cut open Claude's stomach. Claude runs into the hills and hides for a couple of days until Rock cools off. Does he go get help? Does he call the police? No, he goes back. One time, Rock poured boiling water on Giselle's back after he had slashed her and she ran away to her father. Why she ever came back, who knows? But once when she did, Rock threw a hunting knife at her, which stuck in her leg, and the wound gets infected, and then Rock treats it by pouring boiling water on it. He like opens the wound up and stuffs it with salt and olive oil and spruce gum. It's just crazy. These people are so, so exacerbating and just annoying. Rock would take this torch that he liked. He would take it to people's backs and blister their skin. He would break their ribs and other bones. He beat his sons when they refused to fight each other. He kicked people wearing steel-toed boots. He even shot at people and hit people in the shoulder a couple of times. And then at one point, he decides to pull out all of Claude's teeth with pliers. That wasn't enough. He then hung Claude by the rafters and had the women pluck out his pubic hairs one by one. I could go on. I could go on and on and on, but I'm done with it. The thing that would finally bring about the end was the death of poor Solange. Solange had health problems, and Rock didn't like that. He thought everyone should be healthy, even though he wasn't healthy. So Rock told Solange she needed an enema. He put a hose in her rectum and filled a bag with molasses, oil, and water. He then used the enema, then got a tube and put it down Solange's throat and had the members blow into the tube. For what reason? Who knows? When Solange screamed in pain, Rock made a 4-inch incision in her side, which he said would relieve the pain, and he pulled out a piece of her intestine. Honestly, you can go look this up, because if I were you, I would think I was lying at this point, honestly. The next day, Solange died of peritonitis, with her digestive fluids filling her abdominal cavity. Rock's reaction to Solange's death was unexpected. He was distraught. He even supposedly tried to kill himself by taking an overdose of Tylenol. And then, buckle up, you guys. God speaks to Rock and tells him that Solange is still alive inside of Rock's body. How? In the form of Rock's semen.
I need a break for a second.
Rock then decides what is going to occur is something he calls a reverse birth. Rock is going to give birth to his dead wife, Solange. Solange has been buried at this point. Rock has traveled to Ontario to speak with some other kooks he had contact with. It had been over a week since her death. Her murder is actually correct. So Rock orders poor Claude, who this guy, he's got one testicle and no teeth and he's still coming back. He orders Claude to dig up Solange's body. He then has Gabrielle open Solange's abdomen and pour white vinegar all over her internal organs to keep the worms away from her body. And then they bury her again. Shockingly, Solange does not come back to life. So Rock digs her up again. This time he has Jacques take a hand drill and he drills a hole in Solange's skull. I've been gearing up for this. Okay. I'm going to use the biblical terms here. Rock spills his seed into Solange's skull and tells the cult members that this will resurrect her. You know that spaceship that I talk about sometimes that I wish would come and get me off this earth away from all the craziness? Where is the spaceship when you need it? Maybe I just need to go build one myself. I'd settle for a meteor right now. Solange is not, in fact, resurrected. And Giselle told Rock that Solange had always wanted to be cremated, so then Rock agrees to cremate her. But before they burn the body, Rock tells Gabrielle to remove one of Solange's ribs, which he makes a necklace out of. He made a necklace out of her rib. After the cremation, all of the cult members take little bits of Solange's bones to keep. Rock took his share of the bones and put them in a jar with some olive oil, and then from time to time, he would masturbate into the jar to try to resurrect Solange. For the next several months, there is a lot of arguing and some of the cult members escape. Rock also engages in some very brutal acts of torture, especially towards Giselle. But poor Gabrielle got the worst of it. One night, Rock was drunk and he stabbed her with a hunting knife in the hand. Her arm got gangrene, and so Rock just chopped it off. Just chopped her arm off with a cleaver. She escapes and she does go to the hospital. The hospital, of course, calls the police, and finally, on August 16th, 1989, a warrant is issued for Rock's arrest. It took the police 6 weeks to find him. They find him on October 6th, 1989, and then they find out about Solange's murder, the abuse, the torture, all of it. Rock the Rogue goes on trial, and on January 18th, 1993, he is sentenced to life in prison. But in Canada, that means you come up for parole in like 6 or 7 years. Rock was eligible for parole in 1999. Our buddy Roche, Moses, Moyes, Rock doesn't make it to his parole. He's denied once in 2002. But then in 2011, when Rock was 63, another inmate at Dorchester Penitentiary killed Rock in prison. He was found dead in his cell. Up until that time, Nicole, Giselle, and others were still full believers in Rock. He has over 20 children spread across the United States in different foster homes. Some of them are now obviously adults. Some of them probably don't even realize who their father was. This horrific story was made into a film in 2002 called Savage Messiah. Of course, I watched it to get ready for this episode. It stars Luc Picard as Rock and Polly Walker as Paula Jackson, the social worker who finally took on this cult and helped bring it down. And hers is the story that I might want to tell at a different point. Gabrielle ends up writing a book called Alliance of the Sheep. The movie is free on FilmRise, and if you want to watch it, I would suggest it. It's a good film. The performances are good, and if you don't already hate Rock, you'll hate him after that. I wish I had some great words of wisdom or some way to wrap this up in a nice bow, but I don't. This is just an ugly story, a very, very ugly story about a sick and disgusting piece of human trash and the lost and broken people who followed him. And yeah, it's just awful. What terrifies me the most is that there are 100 more Rocks, 1,000 more Rocks out there right now, preaching hate, preaching divisionism, preaching apocalyptic bullshit. And for each of those Rocks, they've got a handful of followers. The next story like this is just waiting to be uncovered. And when it is, we'll be right here talking about it all over again. We just don't do a very good job of learning from history, do we, my friends? Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video. Subscribe to my channel if you want to see more from me. And if you really want to support our community, join my Patreon. I'm Dining with Death on Patreon. And if you want to donate a couple bucks a month, that's fine with me. It supports the channel, and the end goal there is to raise money to donate to police departments that have cold case DNA in storage that cannot be tested because there's no money to test it. We want to test that DNA, solve some cold cases, and get the perpetrator's DNA in the system in case they're linked to other crimes. I can only do that with your help. I sure appreciate you being here. Thank you so much for your support and for spending part of your day with me. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.